This is the North Africa Journal, and thank you for downloading this podcast. For more podcast information and user rules, please visit north-africa.com/podcast.
Let's go back very quickly to perhaps my first question, but I'm actually curious to see whether you agree that from a security perspective, there has been some geographical shifting, meaning that what used to be a substantial theater of operation for the Al-Qaeda and Al-Qaeda and its proxies now, anyway, in places like Northern Africa, Algeria particularly, that theater of operation has moved relatively away, generally away, that is, particularly away from the northern side to the surrounding weaker countries, particularly the Sahel in general. Mm-hmm. With the extension of crises in West Africa and East Africa, I wonder if you agree that the concern has been a lot less about Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb north, that is, much more now south, particularly the Sahel, and as things continue to erode and get worse in places like Côte d'Ivoire, who knows, Burkina Faso perhaps. I don't know whether you agree with that view in general.
No, definitely. The shift south. But that's because there's a soft underbelly in the Sahel of instability that's been going on for years. And it seemed like 2010 was going to be the year when a number of crises were going to come to a close, especially the Ivorian crisis. Mm. Ivory Coast was supposed to have elections in 2005. Moved to 2006 and then moved to 2007, and then finally they got them underway in 2010. Instead of stabilizing the country and closing the process that began with the civil war of 2002, they've actually revitalized it, the war, that is. Now we've got two presidents in Ivory Coast, both of them with the government. Unfortunately, the one that is the actual loser of the election is the one who controls the army and the media. So, unfortunately, this kind of protagonism continues in Africa and creates the kind of instability that then favors anarchist groups or terrorist groups to set up bases in these countries that essentially remain, I don't think lawless is the term, but some of them are actually literally lawless, like Guinea-Bissau, and others have very weak control and territory that makes it very easy to lose control. And we're talking countries all around surrounding the Sahara Desert. So it's an ideal location for subversive groups to set up bases and to launch operations. We haven't heard as much about, I think, Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb this year because it was overshadowed by Al-Qaeda in Yemen or Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, as it's known. And so the problem really is one of attention. There have been European hostages in 2010, and Europeans were killed in Niger and Mali, tourists or mostly, but they weren't North American. So I think had more North Americans been involved with the Americans, I think we would have heard more about the dangers in this area.
Yeah. I mean, the fact that we've seen very little to no terror activity in Algeria, for instance, which has been sort of for, you know, several years a target. And we've seen an escalation in the Sahel, Mauritania, Mali, Niger, and now who knows where it's going to go. I wonder whether that suggests that the security forces up in the north are doing a much better job securing the region, fighting and in their offensive against the terror organizations, or there's been a shift in strategy by Al-Qaeda subsidiary, perhaps driven by orders, perhaps, or guidance from Qaeda Central, that the focus ought to be on extremely vulnerable regions, as opposed to countries that, like Algeria, that are benefiting from a very strong oil revenues and are fueling their military capabilities or funding their military capabilities, therefore becoming extremely impossible to deal with. I really do wonder whether, again, it's again an improvement in the Algerian military that is sort of leading Al-Qaeda to look elsewhere, or it's also partly a deliberate strategy to look for very weak countries. I mean, we know that the folks who lead Al-Qaeda in the Sahel have also been active seeking, you know, to position themselves in Burkina Faso. They've also been very active seeking, you know, or sending messages to, you know, to Muslim groups in Nigeria, you know, whenever problems occur in that part of the world. So again, we really haven't seen the end of the story, and the fact that 2010 has been a very quiet period on the security front in the north, that is, whether one has to anticipate some kind of a resumption, or at least some kind of event that would signal to the rest of the world, to the media, to the world, to North Africans, essentially, that Al-Qaeda is there and is there to stay. You know, as they often do, you know, very sensational, you know, attacks to really get the attention and get the media to talk about them. So, again, this, you know, I mean, the most striking thing, perhaps, in 2010 was this lack of activity in the north, much more focus on, you know, these newer battlefront regions of Mauritania, where, as you mentioned, you know, there've been a lot of Europeans being abducted, and some sadly killed.
Yeah. To add to that, just a few weeks ago, the Algerian army claimed to have arrested at least 10 terrorists who were in the southern Sahara, in the southern Algerian Sahara. So it's still always in the south on the fringe. Now, I think, though, the full test for Algeria and for Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb has not come yet. I think that test will come when the West, when NATO stops the fighting in Afghanistan. I think at that point we will see a number of the foreign fighters who are in Afghanistan, and perhaps, I mean, some of them are probably still in Iraq, come back to their original countries. And that could stimulate something. This is what happened in 92, after all. Mm. After years, although 92 came after years of, when the Algerian civil war erupted, there had been some years of harsh economic policies that tried to impose market reforms on an unprepared population. There were food riots that preceded these, you know, the problem. And then you had the end of the Afghan war, and many of the Muslim fighters who were, well, the Mujahideen who were not Afghan, returned home, with having received plenty of battle training, and finding a situation ripe for violence. So I think the full test hasn't come yet, for at least for the northern countries, particularly Algeria.
That's right. That's right.
Sorry.
Is there in your mind a a link with, or at least some kind of a relationship between what's happening in Côte d'Ivoire and elsewhere, obviously, in the region, and what North Africa can do, if anything. I mean, is there a particular, you know, a particular stake in the stabilization of a place like Côte d'Ivoire and other regions as well?
Okay, well, here's my thing. Nothing in the short term, but long term and macro, yes. Let's consider Ivory Coast's traditional role before the Civil War, starting in 2002. Ivory Coast was perhaps the richest country in West Africa. It was one of the most stable countries in Africa, in sub-Saharan Africa. And it was an importer of labor. In other words, the farmhands came from all neighbors, including Burkina Faso, which has a big role in this crisis, actually. Burkina Faso, Senegal, Nigeria, Ghana. We have a lot of migrant workers. It was an importer of labor. So the Civil War and the separation and will affect agriculture in particular. And apart from the fact that cocoa prices will go up considerably without bringing any benefits to the farmers who grow the cocoa, because they'll go up because of speculation and shortage, not because these farmers will get any extra revenue.
Mm.
This will put a much bigger migration pressure toward the north. In other words, Ivory Coast was sort of a valve to absorb excess labor. And now this valve is shut. So it'll put more pressure on the Sahara and more migration pressure. Only the north will do at this point. Ghana has recently become an oil producing country. And, mm-hmm. and unfortunately, Ivory Coast, is missing this opportunity because of its instability and because of the selfishness of its political leaders. Let's put it quite frankly, the selfishness
right.
of its
yeah.
political leaders. There are many things they are going to miss out on, much investment. Now, oil does not bring in a lot of employment for local populations.
Right.
It does bring revenue
yeah.
for infrastructure that can then help other areas. I mean, the Ivory Coast is an exporting... As a very important port for the region. I mean, Ivory Coast serves as a port for many landlocked countries in the area. Mali, for example. Mali ships everything through Ivory Coast. Now Mali is already shifting to Ghana. So this political crisis is a very unwelcome, extremely silly, beyond words.
Right.
Selfishness is really incalculable what they're doing. They're ruining a population because of absolute, and it's shameful.
Yeah.
But it'll create pressure, migration pressure, on the north. And this pressure is combines with the fact that the region, the Sahel has become the main trading point for illegal drugs from South America going to Europe, and arms smuggling. So we have the 2011 does not look like a there are few prospects of success in for the region in 2011.
Yeah, I agree. I think what we're facing is really an explosive situation across the board in most of the northern part of sub-Sahara Africa. I mean, if we use Sudan as an example of that. I think Sudan can be a template, albeit sort of a big template, of what most other countries in the region are facing, namely divides along religious lines, whether it's Mali, and whether it's Burkina Faso, Niger, Côte d'Ivoire, particularly is an excellent example of that, where essentially the north is very Muslim, the south is very Christian.
Yeah, but Côte d'Ivoire is even more complex than that, because Côte d'Ivoire is, the fight seems to be over citizenship more than kinship.
That is correct, but it is...
Because of the migration that it had over the years.
That's right, but it's still a factor in the way politicians identify themselves.
Yeah, and of course we haven't even mentioned Nigeria.
That's
which
correct.
Which in 2010 had at least two or three bouts of inter-ethnic Muslim-Christian
For a long while, that's correct.
Riots that caused altogether at least 1,000 dead. And Nigeria is having an election in 2011, an important election. We will see if President Goodluck has good luck, and because he would be Goodluck Jonathan.
That's right. Now
that's his name. He would be the first president from the South, normally, and the first Christian president.
That's right. That's actually an interesting one.
And Nigeria is next door to Ivory Coast. And another problem emerged. Now there are allegations of that in Gabon. Gabon, an oil-producing country, normally no one ever hears anything about it, quite stable, one of the countries that shares with us the epithet of Switzerland of Africa. It's still located just where, at the corner of where West Africa meets Central Africa.
That's right, just below Cameroon, yeah.
Yeah, it turns out now that the election was completely false, and that the president, the son of the president who won, the son of the original president, whose name escapes me at this moment, Bongo, Omar Bongo, was not the actual winner, but his rival was.
Mm.
So now we will see what happens in this country, traditionally quite rather quiet.
That's right.
It's really one story after another. There was a coup in Niger this year.
Yep.
Actually, a coup that was welcomed by most people because Tanja was not a very effective leader, and it seems that the coup leaders are seriously intent on bringing some kind of positive change. So in Niger, ironically, Niger and Mali are some of the most politically wise. They've had much wiser leadership than their neighbors, but they're weak economically and geographically. They're too loose. There's too much desert.
Yep.
Difficult to control.
So in addition to the religious divides that you see from the northern part of the Sahel to many of the countries that we cited, there's also the ethnic divide, particularly in the north, where many of the differences are along the line of blacks on one side, black Africans on one side, and Arabo-Africans on the other side, a divide that has exacerbated tension in places like Mali and Niger, where the Tuaregs, essentially representing the Arabo-African, if you will, have been essentially at odds with the political elite in places like Bamako and Mali, and ethnic differences play a substantial role. I mean, in places like Mauritania, and perhaps many of the listeners would probably be surprised to hear that, slavery still exists.
It's a big problem.
It's really not necessarily a state. It's illegal.
It's illegal, and actually,
but servitude is there.
But I believe some human rights activists had published a report against slavery, and they were actually arrested, or at least ordered to the newspaper that published it was shut down.
Yeah.
That was a few days ago.
That's typical. So, in light of all of these various sort of areas of stress and tension, there's also the economic equation that really these regions are essentially seen as a hub for whatever commodity and resources they can be extracted. Côte d'Ivoire is obviously cocoa. You talked about Ghana and oil, but clearly West
Africa. Ghana's cocoa too, and Cote d'Ivoire could have oil. It could have
as well. That's
lots
correct.
Of mining, but no one, it's lost, it's missed out on investment in the last 10 years. And
that's correct.
The myopia and selfishness of its leaders is keeping it out for a lot longer now.
That's right. I mean, there's really no political leadership to ensure that for investments, as small as they can be, you know, are channeled in the right place, namely education, infrastructure building, poverty alleviation, all of that stuff that really would make, you know, these countries interesting and good countries to do business with. Sadly, that's not happening. So what happens is the rule of law disappears, lawlessness takes over, and then you have these incredible links that are being built with Central America.
Yes, that's what happened in Guinea-Bissau, basically.
Exactly, yeah. Particularly Guinea-Bissau, but, you know, elsewhere as well. And at some point, when you look at that, you begin to wonder what is the role of North Africa. And I think that two things are happening. One, there is willingness from or the interest from the West, particularly U.S., NATO, France, and others, to sort of use North Africa as a buffer zone. Rightly so, but it's a difficult political endeavor to follow. But again, there is a possibility, because the second point is that there's a willingness from some North African nations to go along and play that role, because it sort of gives them an aura of regional leadership. Correct? I think that the one country that is emerging as sort of the leading player there is Algeria, for a number of reasons. One, obviously, it has the resources, and you need that. I mean, you have to have all the military hardware and capabilities that money can buy, and that couldn't have happened if they didn't have a big oil base and oil export capabilities. And so it's also geographically a pretty massive country. I mean, the second in the continent, and surrounding Morocco, Mauritania, Mali, Niger, Libya, and Tunisia, or in the middle of those countries, sorry. And so it does have a visibility, a strong presence in the north, very strong presence in Sahel by virtue of its borders with some of these countries. There's been some new initiatives recently to put together a multi-country task force with Algeria, Mauritania, Mali, and Niger joining forces to police the region, if you will, and obviously, it's a tough berth for that particular organization in general, because there's a lot of political dimensions that haven't been agreed upon, namely who takes the lead. Clearly, Algeria wants to. Mauritania is also very much keen on playing that role for a couple of reasons. One, it is seeking to really put a lot of resources to avoid the settlement of Al-Qaeda in its region, and therefore being less prone to Al-Qaeda attack, therefore being proactive is what the Mauritanian government is seeking to do. And secondly, it's clearly been seen, as many analysts suggest, as a proxy to France. So France wouldn't put all its eggs in the Algerian basket, so to speak, and would rely more on Mauritania to play a leading role. There's also the unclear role of Morocco. Morocco, not being part of the Sahel, still wants to be part of that organization, and yet, again, supported by France and NATO and the U.S., but Algeria has been very much adamant that Morocco shouldn't be part of that by virtue of it not being part of the Sahel in general. Again, I think the role of the North is going to be interesting. And I don't know whether you see that from your own research, that North Africa, I know you must be aware that Libya, we know that Libya has been a key player in attempting to play that buffer zone in the immigration debate. But
yeah, Libya has been playing that buffer zone for not for different reasons. Libya uses the migration issue to its advantage. I mean, let's not forget. In the 90s, when Gaddafi decided to turn away from the Arab world, utopia to the Pan-African one, mm-hmm. he decided to invite all Africans to come. No problem, you come. No visa for you. And so many Africans came from all over the continent. They settled in Tripoli, creating a lot of tension there, and many of them felt the pressure to leave. Mm. And also because there were no jobs, really. Other than domestic workers and a few, there was no agriculture to speak of. So created really the pressure to move. I mean, Libya is where most of the boats that end up in Malta and Italy come from. Mm. It's a political weapon that Libya uses to establish, to keep good relations with Europe, in other words, to keep at least, to make itself necessary to Europe, not just for oil. Mm. It gets, Libya recently demanded 5 billion euros in order to help it deal with the border issue and to control migration. Mm. Libya also closed the UNHCR office, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, mm. So that migrants cannot apply for asylum status in Tripoli. So it really, again, it forces these migrants to get on a boat, risk their lives, and go to Europe, and then do all these things when they land. And now the Europe has enforced tougher policies. So it, unfortunately, this, the migration in you know, Libya plays a weird leadership role in Africa. It's odd.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So final discussion on this topic here is the stance or the position of Egypt vis-a-vis sub-Sahara. Is it essentially a Sudan story, or does it go beyond Sudan for Egypt?
It goes beyond, but Sudan is the playing ground.
It's the big elephant.
Yes, Sudan is, by the way, Africa's largest country.
That's right.
There are a number of, let's say, key issues to consider.
But just a quick question: for how long do you think it'll remain the biggest African country?
Sudan until January.
Do you think it'll split?
No, but actually, it'll still be, because South Sudan is not that big. What the area considered South Sudan is not that big.
Oh, okay. Just, so even without South Sudan, it will remain
still,
it could still
maintain at least that primacy. But there is no doubt that the in 2011, the first big event in Africa will be the referendum for the separation of South Sudan, which is a given. It will separate. The problem is, what isn't a given is what will happen. There are many cases, there's a big case that can be made to suggest that a war could break out again. I mean, Sudan has, since being independent in 1956, Sudan has technically had only 5 or 6 years without civil war. So this could resume, or because of the efforts of some countries and the way that the resources are distributed geographically and then managed, it could be that Sudan avoids this fate. Mm. Let's look at the more positive one. The reason why the main concern for North Sudan is that South Sudan has most of the oil. And there's a region in between the north and the south called Abyei. Abyei will hold a separate referendum on the same day, January 9th, 2011, to decide whether or not to join South Sudan or North Sudan. Now, more likely, they will stay with the south. South Sudan has U.S. support. South Sudan could become quite an important country in its own right, a small population and big resource, oil. And Abyei would add to that. Abyei is the richest single oil area in Sudan. Unfortunately for these two, the pipelines go north to Sudan. That's where the port is. And right now, the infrastructure is designed along these lines. So China gets 7% of all its oil from Sudan. Huge amount. This is a big question.
Yeah.
What will happen?
It will be interesting. And again, it really goes along the lines of what I think we talked about earlier, that these religious and ethnic divides are going to be a massive test for all most African nations in the next several years. And clearly, I think there's been a strategy out of Morocco to beef up this concept of decentralization and autonomy to the region so that, you know, so that in the case of the Western Sahara, there, you know, they can certainly use that as a way to, you know, make their case in favor of a Moroccan Western Sahara. But I think what we're seeing is really an implosion of all of these countries along ethnic, religious lines, and that doesn't really bode well.
No, it doesn't.
From a security perspective.
Yeah, and in fact, I mean, in our first part, the previous part, I mentioned, everyone is talking about African unity. I mean, Gaddafi is talking about it, but really,
not going to happen.
The trend is not unity. The trend is looks like more separation, and this is Sudan is one. You know, we've got the West African issues, and apart from all this, you know, Egypt gets the lifeblood of Egypt remains the Nile. Now, this originates in Ethiopia, and there are treaties that exist with unified Sudan that help to feed, make sure that no country will have a dam. I'm talking about physical structure here. To block the flow of the Nile. Mm-hmm. This will inevitably change. We could have tension over water supply. This could lead to a number of minor proxy wars with the region. For example, it is said that Egypt has targeted Ethiopia, with which it's had many arguments, by funding or helping the Somali insurgents, whose main enemy is Ethiopia.
Mm.
So there's you see what's happening in a number. Yeah. And then you've got Eritrea, and Eritrea is another country that's been helping the Shabab. So you've got all kinds of number of regional tensions resolving, not just around ethnic lines, but around resources and not just oil.
Yeah, and so you know, if you really look at this pretty bleak picture, which sadly, you know, that's what both you and I are concluding. You know, let's say you are an international company or a potential investor. You know, what do you do? I mean, do you concentrate your efforts on the countries that are bigger, that have a much more stable political environment, say North Africa, Nigeria, South Africa, perhaps, or do you venture into these markets where there's, you know, let's face it, if you're an oil company or if you are a mining company, you really can't neglect those countries. I mean, they're very much, you know, full of potential.
Yeah, of course you can't, because they all have very important reasons, whether it's oil. Or how about the Democratic Republic of Congo, which has two important, apart from everything else, minerals that are essential components in cell phones and laptops, coltan and cassiterite.
Yeah.
The largest, as fate would have it, the largest supply. And Congo is a microcosm of all of Africa's problems all in one. I mean, many forget that the Congo and regions around it were involved in a war between 1998 and 2002, which killed at least 2 million people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So in a nutshell, if you don't take the risk to get involved, the Chinese will come along and take over.
They come along because They don't make any demands. They don't care what your political system is. They just come.
They cut deals. They cut deals.
And you know who's following in these footsteps?
No.
Latin America, particularly Brazil.
Yeah, they're taking up. They're learning from the Chinese. I mean, clearly they
don't make any special. And this is really the way. Their ways seem to be more practical.
Yeah, it's truly an economic trade. I mean, I've learned that essentially, you know, if you can get paid as a Chinese company working in in mining or real estate. I'm sorry, real estate construction, for example, infrastructure, so on and so forth. But if that country doesn't have the ability to pay you cash, they can actually pay you in commodities, and you can sell, you as a Chinese company, sell that commodity to the Chinese government. which is
or to neighbors.
I mean, it's speaking of really innovative approach. And by the way, some of the analysts that really follow sub-Saharan Africa have told me that this has created actually wealth. And I don't mean necessarily wealth, the kind of wealth that individuals, business people sort of take advantage, but they have lifted some local economies out of out of trouble just by providing.
Like Mozambique, Angola, there are lots of these cases. There are unlikely success stories in Africa in some cases.
That's right. Absolutely.
You know, one of the unlikely success stories recently has been Malawi, you know, with agriculture. And few pearls here and there. But really, the trend in 2010, whereas things were looking up, you know, a year ago, if we were to have this discussion a year ago, things were looking up for West Africa. The elections hadn't happened yet, and Ivory Coast had one of its most stable years in a decade. Now it seems the reverse. It's really Africa is a month-by-month situation.
So the discussion we had 2 months ago about thinking that, the decade of Africa is here, or Africa is the next big thing, you're reassessing that. I sense that you're not convinced yet.
No, well, it is in many ways. I mean, it's the one continent that hasn't had the kind of growth that at one point or another has come to all the other regions.
Yeah.
And Africa has all the cards to be important. I mean, it holds so much that everyone wants, not just the West.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone wants what Africa has. But unfortunately, the governance issues and other and this political protagonism, and let's call it that, political protagonism, is what's keeping Africa below its potential.
Yeah. Absolutely. So,
this was the North Africa Journal podcast. Thank you for listening.